2021-243-CV, Logic Corp. Mexico S.A. de C.V. versus Jorge Andrade.
May it please the court, time and questions permitting, I hope to address three topics. The first is the sole administrator's power under the bylaws to waive Article 6, followed the Forum Selection Clause. Second, whether the claims at issue fall within Article 6, which requires some understanding of what's called the Calvo Clause in Article 5. And third is whether Mr. Andrade impliedly waived the right to assert Article 6 by his litigation conduct. Article 21 gives broad powers to the sole administrator, not just for litigation, but for management. Within the section about his litigation powers to control for the corporation, it states that his power of attorney is the broadest power of attorney, and it is without limitation. And I think the problem for Mr. Andrade is that he keeps trying to find a limitation where none is stated. Whenever the sole administrator is mentioned in the bylaws expressly by name, there is no limitation in that section. The effect of becoming the sole administrator is to make one of the otherwise equal partners, in effect, a de facto majority shareholder.
Mr. Hughes, how do you respond to their argument that this Article 21 does not give SOSA the authority to waive Andrade's right to enforce the Forum Selection Clause?
First, that's exactly what it says. He has the power to waive jurisdiction of domicile. The only section that mentions jurisdiction of domicile, or those two words, are Article 6. It's the only one that recognizes the power altogether, and it's a sensible provision because, remember, these people start out as equal shareholders. If the corporation, if without some way to break the tie, he could stymie the corporation's ability to enforce any remedies it might need against him. And so, for example, remember, this is a cross-border business. It was a setup to do business with Mr. Andrade's corporations across the border. And so if the Logicor Mexico needed to come to Texas or the United States to enforce a remedy against him, he could stymie the corporation by saying, oh no, Article 6, you all got to go back. If the corporation, for example, needed injunctive relief here in Texas, they would have to go back to Texas and remember, to Mexico. But again, Mr. Andrade, as the bylaws say, does domiciled here in Texas. So how would you get a contempt citation from a Mexican court that you could automatically enforce here?
But why couldn't he bring the lawsuits in Mexico? What stops one partner from suing Andrade in Mexico to get the injunctive relief he has, at least as it pertains to Jose Andrade, not to the companies that he may own, JED or the United States companies?
My point is they could file it, but enforcement would be difficult because Mr. Andrade and his activities would be here in Texas. And anytime you would try, if you tried to get a civil contempt citation from a Mexican court, how would you enforce it here in Texas? The moment the corporation files suit here, Mr. Andrade waives Article 6, and under their reasoning, it goes to Texas. But the point of it is, if you accept their construction, which their construction is that this power to waive only applies to suits involving third parties, not him, then the provision becomes meaningless. It has no meaning, and we're not supposed to do that. For example, if Logicor Mexico sues a third party in Texas or New Mexico, they have no need to waive jurisdiction of domicile, and the other party can enforce it. Likewise, if Logicor Mexico is sued by a third party outside of Nuevo León, sued here in the United States, they can't raise the Forum Selection Clause against somebody who didn't sign the agreement.
So that Forum Selection Clause, I question the translation just because it just seems to be worded a little odd with the one and others. language, but it seems to me both sides are arguing that it's limited to disputes between the corporation and shareholders or disputes between shareholders. Yes?
Well, yes. That's what it says on its face. And it is awkward.
And how are we supposed to review that contract as a standard of review? I mean, if we're looking at what we're here is, which is the granting of a motion to dismiss.
Well, the interpretation of the contract's a question of law. Neither side says that it's ambiguous in some sense, and therefore you have to take the words as it's written.
And so as written, what do the words say? I mean, isn't that where we're arguing? What do the words actually say as a matter of law?
Well, okay. The translation, which is what we have to go by, and it's kind of an awkward.
Very.
It is.
And I hate to take a detour, but they keep trying to interpret Article 6 in light of Article 5, which is the Calvo Clause. And to understand Article 6, because it's worded a little awkward. It doesn't say any and all disputes. It just says in case of conflict or controversy between one or the others. And then it says waiving any forum that may favor them due to their domicile. Well, that means they're not waiving all forums, just those in which the forum would be based on their residence. For example, if the jurisdiction of the court were based on the locus of the cause of action, that wouldn't be waived, which is why it goes back to Article 5, which is the Calvo Clause. The purpose of the Calvo Clause is to make sure, it basically is to enforce the Mexican Constitution that Mexico forbids foreigners from owning Mexican property. And they have passed numerous laws to ensure that Mexican businesses will be regulated under Mexican law and that foreigners cannot come in and try to argue that foreign law regulates what is otherwise a Mexican company. And if you look carefully at Article 5, which is what they're trying to interpret this, it says that the foreign partners are bound before the Ministry of Foreign Affairs to be considered Mexican citizens, one, with respect to the shares they may acquire or own in such partnership, or the rights or obligations from agreements executed by the partnership with Mexican authorities, and with the rights, obligations, or shares, interests in such partnership that the partnership owns. So therefore, what I think Article 6 was created was to enforce the Calvo Clause, to ensure that disputes over corporate ownership, corporate shares, and what corp property did or did not belong to the corporation, which should be handled in Mexico.
Now, this waiver that you're arguing is an implicit waiver by filing the lawsuit, correct? There isn't any explicit waiver anywhere.
Well, there's two waivers. One is that simply the sole administrator through the corporation may waive enforcement against the corporation. And second, the implied waiver under the new Lalonde standard. I might add that what you might call a unilateral and enforceable clause is not that strange. In the First Merit Bank case cited in our brief, the Supreme Court talks about arbitration clauses where one party is bound to the arbitration agreement and the other party has the option to opt out and go litigate. And in those cases in which you don't have a standalone arbitration agreement, but in fact it's agreement within a larger contract, the courts have held that that sort of clause is enforceable. And at footnote 35, they cite a number of federal cases where that's exactly it. One party is allowed to opt out of arbitration, the courts say that that doesn't mean that it's an illusory contract. And in fact, they followed that in the Advanced PCS case several years later. And then there's also a federal district court case That I didn't cite in the brief, Haffer versus Vanderbilt Mortgage at 793 F. Sub. 2nd, 987, where the creditor, the mortgage gave the creditor the option to either sue or arbitrate, but the debtor had to arbitrate. And they said that that's an enforceable agreement. Now,
what about your second argument before we run out of time, Mr. Hughes, that this claim doesn't fall within Article 6? Well, what about this claim doesn't match up with Article 6?
Well, that's because of the word, the unusual wording that Justice Contreras just mentioned. What is missing from this is it doesn't, we don't have the words arise from or any or all. And the second is that it waives only forums based on domicile, which goes back to the Calvo Clause. So it doesn't have the words that expand it beyond rights that arise from the agreement itself. Because otherwise, unless we say that with that, because it doesn't expand the list of disputes, they have to be claims that would not exist but for the bylaws, and the bylaws are an element of the claim.
But so in response to that, Appley has said a key issue in this dispute is whether Andrade had the right to sign this subordination agreement with the this company that he sold to. And you're saying that, so how is it that you can make that claim without going to the bylaws?
Well,
I mean, whether he had the authority, doesn't that, you know, still remain an issue here?
I think Mr. Andrade is erecting a straw man and mischaracterizing the argument. We have never said that his authority to sign contracts depends on the bylaws. And incredibly, he didn't make that argument in the trial court either. In fact, he never claimed that he did have the authority. He didn't plead it, he didn't argue it in his motion to dismiss. And he certainly didn't say in the trial court that his any authority he had to sign must come from the bylaws themselves. And he even admitted that our fraud theory, what we call the independent fraudster argument, doesn't require him to have any connection with the corporation at all.
But he was still a shareholder at the time this lawsuit was filed, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
But once again, he never claimed that the bylaws gave shareholders some right not given to sign these agreements, and he never made that argument. So without limiting it to claims that must arise, that would not exist but for the bylaws, we don't know what disputes are involved. And it's I think the importance of the Pinto case is that the Pinto case that they talk about is they spend a lot of time trying to define the terms arise from and the terms any and all as how they expand that. Well, if you don't need those terms to expand the scope beyond claims that depend on the bylaws themselves, then Pinto wasted a great deal of ink. And you're essentially inserting phrases or terms into Article 6 that aren't there.
Let me ask you about the dual litigation that you've argued. What claims will remain here if, you know, Logic Corp Mexico is sent to Mexico? You're saying that there's going to be dual litigation. So Appley has said that Andrade showed the court that Logic Corp, one of the corporations, was actually defunct.
Okay, well.
But what about Lean Cargo? Is that, I think you said they're identical claims?
The plaintiff, the original.
We'll give you a little bit more time to answer the question.
I'm sorry.
Don't worry about the time running out. Keep
the original plaintiffs were Lean Cargo and Logic Corp Mexico, both companies in which Mr. Sosa was involved. Lean Cargo made the identical claims that Logic Corp Mexico made, and those are not bound by the forum selection clause, and they stayed here. Second, the Logic Corp Mexico company themselves sued Mr. Andrade claiming he fraudulently represented his authority to sign the subordination agreement, and further, that he violated a provision in the sales agreement that he would cause Logicorp Mexico to continue to do business. Now, that's tied to our claims, that in other words, that there would be a stream of revenue, a business from Logicorp Mexico to Logicorp U.S., and of course, the reason the buyers wanted that is they wanted a stream of revenue to pay off Mr. Andrade. Well, that relates to his fraud claim that he told us, don't worry, keep doing business with Logicorp U.S. and you were going to get paid. When in fact, he knew that we wouldn't get paid because of the subordination agreement. And he knew that the money that the Logicorp U.S. companies were raking in from doing the work, doing the transport from Logicorp Mexico, that was being used to pay him, and he made a great deal of money.
And the witnesses that you talked about that are all U.S. residents that will have to testify in these trials, is it the same witnesses that would have to testify in both if the proceedings continue in both forums?
Probably. We provided the list of persons with relevant knowledge from Mr. Andrade. That's what Andrade says are people that knows about the case. He identified three individuals who, by the way, he also said were responsible third parties, meaning he was going to point the finger of blame at them. He also identified several third-party corporations from the lawsuit, lenders, and then there was a holding company, Logicorp Acquisition, one of which he also said was a responsible third party. And yeah, okay. There will have to be evidence from all of them, and we don't think they will voluntarily come to Mexico, especially since our claims will be pointing the finger at them, and he's pointing the finger at them. Now, unless there are any other questions, the red light's blinking.
Yes.
So we ask.
we'll continue on rebuttal.
Certainly.
Thank you. I'll give you extra time if you need it, sir, since I kept Mr. Hughes a little longer.
May it please the court?
Yes, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm going to begin by addressing the topics that Mr. Hughes just discussed, and then, time permitting, I will touch on some other points. With regard to Article 21, Mr. Hughes says that his interpretation is exactly what it says. But the problem is the words Forum Selection Clause never appear in Article 21. Article 21, the plain language, never says that Mr. Sosa has the right to act on behalf of Logicorp Mexico to waive the Forum Selection Clause in Article 6. Rather, they have to take the words waiver of jurisdiction of domicile and try to equate that to the same thing as the ability to waive the contractual agreement for the Forum Selection Clause. So the words aren't there. They're trying to interpret them into the
But what other words or interpretation can we give to waiver of domicile jurisdiction if it isn't a waiver of a forum selection clause?
Article 21 is a general enabling provision. It gives the sole administrator, Abraham Sosa, a whole slew of different authorities and powers to act on behalf of the corporate entity. So it enables a human being to take action on behalf of the company, doing any number of things, consenting to judgments, answering interrogatories, waiving domicile. And so it enables that individual to go take action on behalf of the company. But there's nothing in there that specifically says that the company can waive the forum selection clause. And really, the major point here is Article 21 and 6 are not incompatible. Article 6 is the specific forum selection clause, and in any event, nothing gives Abraham Sosa, sole administrator, the right to waive Mr. Andrade's rights as one of the signatories to the forum selection clause. To interpret Article 21 that way would lead to absurd results because all of the other powers in the laundry list of Article 21 are similarly situated. So that would mean that SOSA would be able to answer interrogatories on behalf of my client, would be able to consent to judgments on behalf of my client, if we interpret Article 21 that way. That's clearly not what that clause means. It doesn't give...
Are you saying then that Article 21 applies mainly or solely to like third-party actions, that the company deals with other people, and the forum selection clause relates only to the disputes between the shareholders?
Yes, Your Honor. I think the text of Article 6 is very clear that it's an agreement between the corporation and the shareholders. Article 21 is a general granting of powers to enable some human being to take actions on behalf of the corporate entity in any...
And that might be like if they had another a contract with another corporation that had a forum selection clause that may or may not be enforceable between those two parties, if he so chose to do, would have the ability to then waive it.
Correct. Basically, it avoids any sort of procedural technicality argument that might come up where Logicor Mexico can't go collect against some supplier in Honduras or Florida or what have you. It's a sort of a check the box. Here's in the bylaws, we're giving someone authority to act on behalf of this corporation. Nothing in there says Abraham Sosa, as one 50% owner, can act on behalf of and control the rights of the other 50% owner and take actions for him on his behalf in a lawsuit. Nothing says that, and you cannot support that.
We generally see form selection clauses in contracts. We don't have a contract here. We have bylaws of a corporation. Is there case law that similar to this where bylaws have been found to be enforceable?
Yes, Your Honor, I'm glad that you brought that up, because the seminal case on this issue is the 2017 Texas Supreme Court case of Pinto Technology. It's the one that's cited ad nauseum by both parties, and it's exactly this. It's a dispute between a corporation and shareholders. The forum selection clause is contained within the bylaws. And what's very relevant is the arguments that the non-movement attempted in that case are exactly the same as what Mr. Hughes is bringing to this court. Specifically, they said, well, hypothetically, we could have pled our claims without talking about your status as shareholder. We could have done it. And the court says, we don't care. They said, when applied to the forum selection clause in this case, however, an analytical construct that focuses only on the causes of action alleged and a hypothetical world where the agreement, meaning the bylaws, does not exist is inapt. The court goes on to say, even though shareholders and corporations can have relationships without an agreement like the one at issue here, we cannot ignore the reality that an agreement, in fact, governs the relationship. So the Texas Supreme Court just rejected this argument squarely in 2017, that it doesn't matter if they could have done some artful pleadings to get around it. The Supreme Court in that case first says you look at the substance of the facts, not the artful pleadings, not the causes of action. You don't have to have an essential element of a cause of action that implicates the agreement. And then specifically, in the context of corporation versus shareholder, they said, we're not going to look at hypothetical possibilities. In reality, there's bylaws. The bylaws have a form selection clause, and that's what happens in this case.
So dovetailing on that and what Justice DeGadina asked you, then the question becomes, is the lawsuit, if we say, okay, you can't waive it, you know, the domicile, the form selection is a claim between shareholders, is Andrade being sued as a shareholder in these pleadings? Because the lawsuit starts from Logicorp Mexico suing these other companies, and they brought in Andrade, and then Logicorp sues on Andrade directly. So my question is, do the pleadings really fall under a shareholder claim, as you have laid it out this morning, to fall under Article 6? Because we could definitely argue that that's not what he's being sued for as a shareholder.
Yes, Your Honor. I'll start with a direct answer to your question and then elaborate. Logicor Mexico's petition repeatedly references Andrade's status as a shareholder and stockholder in the company. It's at least
that we know he was a shareholder and a stockholder, and just like you said, what the pleadings are. But what is he really being sued for? Is it really a derivative shareholder claim?
It's a claim about what duties, what authority Andrade had as a shareholder, and what duties he owed to the corporation as a shareholder. That's a question of interpretation of the Acta Constitutiva, a Mexican legal document, and it's a question that requires interpretation and application of La Ley General de Sociedades Autónomas, which is specified in the bylaws as the applicable law. And and Logicor Mexico's claims regard the corporate structure of Logicor Mexico. That's in their pleadings in the trial court and in their brief, and they reference that the crux of the issue, to use their words, is did he have authority under the corporate structure to subordinate the debt? And that question can only be answered by applying Mexican law to the Acta Constitutiva. And contrary to Mr. Hughes' representation, when he said that we never argued that the Acta was relevant to this question of authority, we did so at the trial court level. It's in paragraphs 5 and 9 of our reply filed with the trial court, so that it was raised, it was argued in the trial court level. Okay. Mr. Hughes also says that we keep trying to interpret Article 6 in light of Article 5. That's not the case. Article 6 is the form selection clause. It has very clear language, and it states, the corporation and its shareholders expressly submit to the jurisdiction of the competent courts of the city of Monterrey, Nuevo León, in case of conflict or controversy between one and the others, waiving any forum that may favor them due to their domicile. It's very clear language. Mr. Hughes' client never challenged the translation or objected to it in any way at the trial court, and that any challenge to the translation is not preserved on appeal. We referenced Article 5 in our pleading, in our motion, merely to show that there are other provisions of this Acta Constitutiva that show how closely this is tied to Mexican law. We don't need Article 5 to support the form selection clause. It's a separate article, and we're not saying that it's a form selection clause. We merely pointed out that there are numerous places in here, including Article 5, that demonstrate how closely Mexican law is tied into this ACTA. And the legal authority that Mr. Hughes has cited for his argument that the form selection clause only applies to this matters involving the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Calvo, none of that legal authority supports that position. And I'd like to point out first that the first time he's raised this argument is in reply at the appellate level. It was never raised at the trial court, and it was never raised in appellant's brief.
Before we run out of time this morning, I want to direct your attention to what Andre did once litigation as to whether his actions were waiver under the Perry Holmes case, and the factors set out in the Perry Holmes case. It would definitely seem that your client partook of some American jurisdiction before he made claim on his motion to dismiss and would fall under a waiver, taking into effect many of the factors under Perry. How do you respond to that?
Yes, Your Honor, and I respectfully would argue that he did not substantially invoke the judicial process.
Well, I think substantially is the word that we're having to deal with today, because he did partake. It's just whether he substantially invoked.
Right, and so under the factors, I'll quickly run through them. So Andrade is a defendant and not a plaintiff, which weighs in favor of The presumption we start off with, which the presumption is against waiver. It's very clear under the law, and there's a heavy burden to overcome that. So we start in a default of there was no waiver. On top of that, the trial court found there's no waiver. So now at the appellate level, we have two heavy burdens because it's abuse of discretion. So he has to overcome two hurdles here. So Andrade is a defendant, not a plaintiff. Andrade never filed a counterclaim. Andrade
filed a motion for summary judgment I forgot the name of that other company.
Against Lean Cargo? That was after we filed our motion to dismiss, and that may even have been after the court granted it. I'm not sure on the date, but it 100% it was after we filed our motion to dismiss. And as a quick aside, Lean Cargo is not an apples-to-apples situation. They're a Texas company. Andrade has zero involvement with Lean Cargo, which is why we filed at MSJ. We have no idea why they have claims against us. We don't own any part of it, and there's no form selection clause. So that's a totally not an apples-to-apples comparison.
Okay, not to take you off your answer to Justice Benavides, but that motion for summary judgment was granted?
The motion for summary judgment is still under advisement.
I see. Okay. All right. Go ahead and continue, and then I have a follow-up question.
Andrade served no written discovery, no interrogatories, no requests for production, and no requests for admission. Andrade never noticed a deposition. And with regard to the time period, that's what Mr. Hughes and his client hyper-focus on, is this time period. The Texas Supreme Court has held that you cannot look at the time period separate from the rest of the totality of circumstances. That's in the case in re ADM. The Texas Supreme Court has, including in Perry, said it's not just temporal, it's a proportionate analysis. How much of the case happened during the time period? Here, almost nothing happened. Zero depositions had occurred prior to the filing of our motion. We had
Who
not
noticed the deposition of Anderson?
That occurred after we filed our motion.
My understanding from the record is that the deposition of Anderson was attempted to be issued, and you filed several motions to quash, according to the record. And the motion to dismiss was filed 1 week before the depo. So even though the depo wasn't set, it had been attempted, and you filed several motions to quash, thus stalling the deposition of Anderson.
Well, correct.
You also partake in some discovery in trying to produce the agreement and a motion to compel the agreement. So there was some things going on during that time, some discovery fights, as we will call it.
2 points, Your Honor. One, the reason that we quashed that deposition was they insisted on it being in person, and they were trying to set it 8 weeks after the COVID pandemic had erupted, when literally we weren't going out of our homes. So we quashed it a few times. Eventually, by whenever it was July or August, we were a little bit more experienced at navigating COVID, and they refused to do it in person. So eventually we did it in a conference room with plexiglass and things like that. That's why we quashed it. They were trying to do it as literally it was borderline illegal to leave your house, which, by the way, the COVID-19 pandemic is another reason for part of the delay in this case. The Texas Supreme Court issued orders tolling legal deadlines such as statute of limitations. Surely that provides, this unprecedented thing provides some explanation for the delay.
Even though I will agree that the COVID did delay things, the courts never stopped. I mean, the courts never stopped, and I know the litigation never stopped because we never got stopped getting work in any of the courts.
Yeah, we kept working.
We kept working. And I know that several of my colleagues at the trial level kept working. So we could take some of it, but I don't want it to be a COVID reason. You have to understand that.
Understood, Your Honor. And with regard to the discovery, we never were engaged in a discovery battle. Logicor Mexico was engaged in a discovery battle with Logicor US. We had a document that had a confidentiality provision that Logicor US was the holder of the confidentiality, and we said we'll produce it once Logicor US says we can. Logicor US, of course, doesn't have counsel. They're defunct. They haven't had counsel since 2019, so there's no response forthcoming from them. LogiCorp Mexico went and got their motion against their order to compel against LogiCorp US, and we promptly produced, just to touch on that. But here's really what's the most important thing about waiver, Your Honor. The Texas Supreme Court is very, very firm that waiver is a heavy burden, and it takes a lot more than what is here to prove it. For example, in Vesta, Texas Supreme Court case, the defendants engaged in litigation for 2 years. They sent requests for production, noticed 4 depositions, and the plaintiff presented evidence that cost him $200,000, and the court didn't find waiver. The Texas Supreme Court has said you cannot imply waiver by inaction. That's in Re-ADM. And in BAME, a Houston Court of Appeals case, the court chronicles a long line of 6 or 7 cases with depositions, getting ready for trial, filing cross claims, all of these things, and the court found no waiver. There is not a single case I'm aware of where a court has found waiver of a forum selection clause. I've not seen it briefed. There is a waiver of an arbitration clause in Perry, and there's waiver of the statutory right to have a certificate of merit in a professional negligence, and the name of that case is escaping me. Those are the two. In both of those, there was extremely more amounts of litigation activity. And a final point, you still have to show prejudice. Mr. Hughes says, well, the U.S. Supreme Court, they might reverse this. Well, they haven't. As of last night, they haven't reversed it. Even if they did, this court is bound by the Texas Supreme Court. And, I mean, this is an issue where the Supreme Court is vocal. There's probably 10 cases since 2000 where they're saying, you have to show prejudice, you have to show prejudice, no waiver, no waiver, no waiver. So, to me, that issue is very clear, and there's no waiver here.
Let's talk about the inconvenience argument that's been raised. You have said that LogiCorp US is defunct, I think is the word you used a couple of times, and that Lean Cargo, presumably you think, has no basis. There's no basis for it in the litigation, so that's why the motion for summary judgment was filed. So are you arguing that there will not be parallel litigation and two trials with the same evidence, same witnesses, as has been argued by appellant?
2 points on that, and I'll try to go very quickly, Your Honor.
That's okay. We'll give you a little bit extra time since we gave Mr. Hughes some extra time.
First, even if there is parallel litigation, let's just take that situation. That's not enough to show inconvenience. The Texas Supreme Court said that in International Profits and in INRI ADM, they said that having witnesses elsewhere is not enough to show inconvenience, enough to override the clause, and having parallel litigation is not enough. Now, might there be litigation between LogiCorp Mexico and LogiCorp US here? I suppose that cause number is still open. I don't know why they haven't taken a post-judgment default. They haven't had a lawyer in 3 years. The company's defunct. So I don't anticipate that they're going to have any parallel litigation. I think they're just going to take a post-judgment default.
And when you say it's defunct, it just is non-existent anymore, not operating?
They have no assets. They have no employees. They have no operations. They sold all of their assets to a separate trucking company based out of El Paso. They sent all of their creditors notice saying we're done. There's nothing. I know that because Mr. Andrade is a creditor who didn't get paid by them, and so he received a notice. And finally, my last
question. I should ask, is any of that in the record before us, though?
I would have to cross check on that.
The only thing we have is that the word defunct.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's all we have.
It is in the record in Mr. Anderson's deposition that they have no counsel and that they've closed up business. That is in the clerk's record. It was attached to our reply at the trial court level. And my final point on this. The Texas Supreme Court said, if you're going to try to avoid a forum selection clause by these arguments that it's unfair, that's a very heavy burden. I've never seen a case, not once. LogiCorp Mexico doesn't cite to one where a court has found that there was enough to overturn it, and I've never seen one in all my research. In fact, in the Texas Supreme Court case in INRI ADM, the plaintiff was an 80-year-old who had chronic health problems, could not walk well, and was in and out of the hospital. And the Texas Supreme Court said, nope, go to Illinois or whatever state it was. That's not enough. I've never seen a case. So he's asking you to do something that, as far as I know, has never been done in Texas law.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Hughes, how do you argue against that 80-year-old?
And, you know, as I get older, 80 is looking younger and younger.
Well,
for the
of course
record.
It is.
My apologies.
First, let's go back to the fact that they're the ones who are talking about how Article 5, the Calvo Clause, plays with the Forum Selection Clause. The point is that no court in the United States has ever, in fact, enforced it that way. The cases that I cited from the California District Court, Federal District Court, and the Oregon Court of Appeals both had cases where there was a clause very similar to Article 6. And I believe in the one of the cases, there were clauses like both of them. And in neither case did the court say, I'm sorry, we're shutting it down. You'll have to go to Mexico to litigate all this. Now, the next thing is, as the court has noted, this is unusual because it's in bylaws. Now, counsel just said, well, that's the way it was in Pinto. No, it wasn't. Pinto, the clause at issue was in the shareholders' agreement. The shareholders signed an agreement separate from everything else. And it was that agreement that was the basis for the Forum Selection Clause. And it was because the claims involved shareholder oppression and dilution that they fell within the clause. Next is, I don't agree with counsel about how he's characterizing what the sole administrator's power to waive is. It is not a power to act on his behalf. You won't find that in Article 21 at all. What it is a power, or shall we say, an option, not to have the Article 6 enforced against the corporation. And that's the way I have cited the cases involving unilateral arbitration agreements, where one party is bound to arbitrate all disputes with no way out, but the other party has the option to either arbitrate or go to court. And the federal court and the Supreme Court have said, when that's in an agreement in which there are a variety of other promises to support as consideration, that makes the agreement enforceable that way. Now, once again, counsel has repeated the argument here that the way to construe Article 21 is that the power of waiver only applies to litigation with third parties. But then it's meaningless. They don't need it in litigation involving third parties because the third party is not going to be bound by the Forum Selection Clause. In other words, basically, they're making the whole clause superfluous. It has nothing to do there. Now, the other question, and I took issue with this, the test is no longer the substantial invocation of litigation. Under Lalonde, that's what they basically said, we have given variety of tests over the year, so we're going to give you a one-size-fits-all. And that says that the single rule for implied waiver for litigation conduct is whether the litigation conduct, be it action or inaction, in other words, doing nothing, dragging things out, in other words, whether action or demonstrates an intent to relinquish, abandon, or waive the right at issue. And then shortly after that, they say, conduct which is inconsistent with claiming the right may be probative of prejudice.
But we still take the Perry's. I agree with what Lalonde says in the totality of the circumstances, but it still takes the Perry factors into account. We still have to look at the Perry.
Yes, you do have to look at, and that's what the point of it is. Their argument, if I read their brief right, I think I do, is that you can participate in discovery all you want. It doesn't make any difference when. It only makes a difference whether Effectively, your timing of the right prevents you from being able to proceed with the case in the other area.
I agree with you. I don't think that it matters that their motion to compel or their argument was they still partook of discovery. The question is, did they take enough partake? I mean, I don't know how else to call it other than substantial or significant, you know, or just sitting around and doing nothing. I mean, they could have sat around for nothing if they sat around for, let's just take an arbitrary number, for 3 years. That would have been enough to invoke if they just sat around for 3 years and did nothing, if we decide that 3 years is long enough delay.
Well, again, look at the excuse. I think the answer is look at the excuses they threw up. The first one was COVID. COVID balls us up. But the point of it is the case was pending against them on these claims for 8 months before COVID struck us down. And according to them, the whole issue is, did he have authority? Well, one would think that since, and I'll get to it, if they're going to claim that the bylaws gave him that authority, they would have been yelling that from the beginning. But then this gets to their other excuses. What did their counsel say? Their counsel said, I didn't realize it was there until the Mexican lawyer told me about it. Well, Mr. Andrade never said, I didn't know about it. He signed the agreement. They had a Mexican lawyer to tell them.
Right. One final question. What prejudice, assuming at the time we write this, that it's still the law, what prejudice have you demonstrated?
Well, I don't think anyone disputes that we've incurred expense and discovery. And the other prejudice is he can't dispute that the third-party witnesses that he identified, that he says are responsible third parties and therefore partially responsible, are here in the United States. It's unlikely they're going to voluntarily come to Mexico. And assuming we can go through the cumbersome process of trying to get them deposed in a way that would be admissible in the Mexican proceedings, we're still going to have the burden of translation. So I think that establishes prejudice. Now, the other thing is, I did want to mention this, about the nature of the Calvo Clause. If you look, this isn't just a matter of agreement. If you look at page 10 of the translation, which is in the provisional, section 6 basically conditions the bylaws on either, and let me read this, the permit to basically, or the approval of the corporate charter must include a clause for the exclusion of foreigners or the agreement set forth in subsection 1 of Article 21 of the Constitution and pursuant to Articles 15 of the Law of Foreign Investment. If that clause were not in there, they couldn't get the bylaws would never have gone into effect. And if they aren't enforced that way, in this way, then they could very well lose their bylaws. And unless there is any more questions, the red light's blinking.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case will be under submission.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.